Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 6th, 2017. So I have been told. I cannot contain my excitement. The exuberance overflows. Final study session on Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. Any folks who might be listening, if we have casual listeners, this is your first time tuning into The Cows. If you're big Frantz Fanon fans, we have not enjoyed the text. I made that explicitly clear before we started reading the book, that I did not want to read this book. The only reason that we read this book was because listeners unanimously chose this book and then did not participate in the book study session for the most part. It is a difficult book. I will definitely take time to emphasize my displeasure with the book is not based on my puny Negro intellect or it being a challenging read. I think I read a lot of the books that we've covered on our 5 years plus here at the book club. And I think we've read challenging books, big books, books that require some extra thinking to try to process and get what the author is talking about. I just have not found this book to be constructive, coherent in some parts. Some of that is not even, you know, in my view, Fanon is not to blame for that. We're talking about a book that was not originally written in English and a book that had to be edited, not only edited, but translated by numerous whites to get it from across the Atlantic over here so that non-white people like myself could read it in English. Lots of suspected racist fingerprints all over the text. And I would hope the time that we invested in the book, people hopefully learn something. And if anything, should ask questions about anything where you hear a lot of people celebrating and pointing and saying, hey, this is really important. This book is tremendous. You should read it, where you have a lot of people pointing at a text and saying that, and it's supposed to be a book about racism. You should tread with caution. Ask questions and reserve judgment, especially in my opinion, when white people are really excited about a book. And it's been my conclusion that white people for many, many years have been very excited about this here book. Anywho, we will wrap up today. We are finishing up some of the case studies that Fanon shares and some of his clinical observations, which I did find interesting from last week. We'll be finishing those up along with the entire text. Without further ado, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Series C, Effective Intellectual Modifications and Mental Disorders After Torture. In this series, we will group together patients in a fairly serious condition whose disorders appeared immediately after or during the tortures. We shall describe various different groups in this category because we realize that the characteristic morbidity groups correspond to different methods of torture employed, quite independently of its evil effects. whether glaring or hidden, upon the personality. Category number one. After so-called preventive tortures of an indiscriminate nature, we here refer to brutal methods which are directed toward getting prisoners to speak rather than to actual torture. The principle that over and above a certain threshold pain becomes intolerable here takes on singular importance. The aim is to arrive as quickly as possible at that threshold. There is no finicking about. There is a mass attack taking several forms, several policemen striking the prisoner at the same time, four policemen standing around the prisoner and hitting him backward and forward to each other, while another burns his chest with a cigarette, and still another hits the soles of his feet with a stick. Certain methods of torture used in Algeria seem to us to be particularly atrocious. The confidences of those who had been tortured are our reference. A. Injection of water by the mouth, accompanied by an enema of soapy water given at high pressure. B. Introduction of a bottle into the anus. Two forms of torture called, quote, motionless torture. C. The prisoner is placed on his knees with his arms parallel to the ground, the palms of his hand turned upward, his torso and head straight. No movement is allowed. Behind the prisoner, a policeman sitting on a chair keeps him motionless by blows of his truncheon. D. The prisoner is placed standing with his face to the wall, his arms lifted, and his hands against the wall. Here, too, if he makes the slightest movement or shows the slightest sign of relaxing, the blows rain down. We must now point out that there are two categories of people who undergo torture. One, those who know something. Two, those who know nothing. One, those who know something are very rarely seen in hospital centers. Evidently, it may be common knowledge that such and such a patriot has been tortured in the French prisons, but you never meet him as a patient. Two, on the contrary, those who know nothing come very frequently to consult us. We are not here speaking of Algerians taken prisoner during a general arresting or a roundup. They do not come to see us as patients either. We are speaking expressly of those Algerians who do not belong to any organization, who are arrested and brought to police quarters or to farms used as centers of interrogation in order to be tortured there. Symptoms of psychiatric cases encountered. A. Agitated nervous depressions. 4 cases. These are patients who are sad without really being anxious. They are depressed and spend most of their time in bed. They shun contact and are liable to suddenly show signs of very violent agitation, the significance of which is always difficult to grasp. B. Loss of appetite arising from mental causes. 5 cases. These patients present serious problems, for every mental anorexia is accompanied by a phobia against all physical contact with another. The nurse who comes near the patient and tries to touch him, to take his hand, for example, is at once pushed stiffly away. It is not possible to carry out artificial feeding or to administer medicine. C. Motor instability. 11 cases. Here we have to deal with patients who will not keep still. They insist on being alone, and it is difficult to get them to allow themselves to be shut up with the doctor in his consulting room. Two feelings seem to us to be frequent in the first category of tortured people. First, that of suffering injustice. Being tortured night and day for nothing seemed to have broken something in these men. One of these sufferers had a particularly painful experience. After some days of useless torturing, the police came to realize that they were dealing with a peaceable man who knew nothing whatever about anybody in an FLN network. In spite of being convinced of this, a police inspector had said, quote, "Don't let him go like that. Give him a bit more, so that when he gets out, he'll keep quiet." Secondly, there was indifference to all moral arguments. For these patients, there is no just cause. A cause which entrains torture is a weak cause. Therefore, the fighting strength of the cause must at all costs be increased. Its justness must not be questioned. Force is the only thing that counts. Category number 2. After tortures by electricity. In this category, we have placed the Algerian patriots, who were mainly tortured by electricity. In fact, although previously electricity was used as one of the general methods of torture, from September 1956, on certain questionings were carried on exclusively by electricity. Descriptions of psychiatric cases encountered. Local or generalized enthesopathies, 3 cases. These patients felt, quote, pins and needles throughout their bodies. Their hands seemed to be torn off. Their heads seemed to be bursting, and their tongues felt as if they were being swallowed. B. Apathy, abulia, and lack of interest, 7 cases. These are patients who are inert, who cannot make plans, who have no resources, who live from day to day. C. Electricity phobia, fear of touching a switch, of turning on the radio, fear of the telephone. Completely impossible for the doctor to even mention the eventual possibility of electric shock treatment. Category number 3. After the, quote, truth serum. The basic principles of this treatment are well known. When dealing with a patient who seems to suffer from an unconscious inner conflict, which consultations do not manage to externalize, the doctor has recourse to chemical methods of exploration. Pentothal, given by intravenous injections, is the most common serum used to liberate the patient from a conflict which seems to go beyond his powers of adaptation. The doctor intervenes in order to liberate the patient from this, quote, foreign body. It has been generally observed that it is difficult to control the progressive disintegration of psychical processes when using this method. Very often, a spectacular worsening of the illness was observed, or new and quite inexplicable symptoms appeared. Thus, generally speaking, this technique has been more or less abandoned. In Algeria, military doctors and psychiatrists have found a wide field for experiment in police quarters. For if in cases of neurosis, pentothal sweeps away the barriers which bar the way to bringing to light an interior conflict, it ought equally in the case of Algerian patriots to serve to break down the political barrier and make confession easier for the prisoner without having recourse to electricity. Medical tradition lays down that suffering should be avoided. This is the medical form that, quote, subversive war takes. The scenario is as follows. First, quote, "I'm a doctor. I'm not a policeman. I'm here to help you." In this way, after a few days, the confidence of the prisoner is won. After that, I'm going to give you a few injections, for you're badly shaken. For a few days, treatment of any kind at all is given. Vitamins, treatment for heart disease, sugar serums. On the fourth or fifth day, the intravenous injection of pentothal is given. The interrogation begins. Psychiatric symptoms. A. Verbal stereotypy. The patient continually repeats sentences of the type of, I didn't tell them anything, you must believe me, I didn't talk. Such stereotypies are accompanied by a permanent anxiety state. In fact, the patient does not even know whether he has given any information away. The sense of culpability toward the cause he was fighting for, and his brothers-in-arms, whose names and addresses he may have given, he'll weigh so heavily as to be dramatic. No assurance can bring peace to these broken consciences. B. Intellectual or sensory perception clouded. The patient cannot affirm the existence of a given visible object. Reasoning is assimilated, but in undifferentiated fashion. There is a fundamental inability to distinguish between true and false. Everything is true, and everything is false at the same time. C. Fear, amounting to phobia, of all private conversations. This fear is derived from the acute impression that at any moment a fresh interrogation may take place. D. Inhibition. The patient is on his guard. He registers each word of the question that is put to him and elaborates every word of his projected reply. From this comes the impression of a quasi-inhibition with psychical slowing down, interrupted sentences, repetition and faltering, etc. It is obvious that these patients obstinately refuse all intravenous injections. Category number 4. After brainwashing. Recently, much has been said about, quote, psychological action in Algeria. We do not wish to proceed to a critical study of these methods. We are content to bring to mind here their psychiatric consequences. There are two categories of centers where torture by brainwashing is carried on in Algeria. 1. For intellectuals. The principle here is to lead the prisoner on to play a part. We can see that this is a throwback to a particular school of psychosociology. A. Playing the game of collaboration. The intellectual is invited to collaborate, and at the same time reasons for collaboration are brought forward. He is thus obliged to lead a double life. He is a man well known for his patriotism who is imprisoned for preventive reasons. The task undertaken is to attack from the inside those elements which constitute national consciousness. Not only is the intellectual in question expected to collaborate, but he is given orders to discuss matters freely with those opposed to his viewpoint or those who hold back, and to convince them. This is an elegant way of bringing him to focus attention on other patriots, and thus to serve as an informer. If by chance he says that he cannot find any opponents, these latter are pointed out to him. Or else he is told to behave as if he was dealing with such. B. Making public statements on the value of the French heritage and on the merits of colonization. In order to carry out this task as well as possible, the intellectual is surrounded by, quote, political advisors, officers for native affairs, or better still, psychologists, social psychiatrists, sociologists, etc. C. Taking the arguments for the Algerian Revolution and overthrowing them one by one. Algeria is not a nation. It has never been a nation. It will never be a nation. There is no such thing as the, quote, Algerian people. Algerian patriotism is nonsense. The Felagas are ambitious peasants, criminals, and poor mistaken creatures. Taking each theme in turn, the intellectual is expected to make a reasoned statement on it, and the statement must be convincing. Marks, the well-known rewards, are given and counted up at the end of every month. They serve as a means of deciding whether or not the intellectual will be allowed out. D. Leading a totally pathological communal life. To be alone is an act of rebellion, so the intellectual is always with somebody. Silence is also forbidden. Thinking must be done aloud. Evidence of brainwashing. The case was that of a person with a university education who was interned and subjected to brainwashing, which lasted for months on end. One day, the camp officials congratulated him on the progress he had made and announced that he would soon be set free. He knew about the enemy's maneuvers and took care not to take this news too seriously. Their technique was, in fact, to announce to the prisoners that they were going to be freed, and then, a few days before the date fixed to organize a meeting at which collective criticisms are made. At the end of the meeting, the decision is often taken to postpone setting the prisoner free, since he does not seem to present all the signs of a definitive cure. The meeting, say those psychologists who were present at it, has served to draw attention to the nationalistic virus. However, this time there was no subterfuge. The prisoner was freed for good and all. Once outside, in his own town and with his own family, the former prisoner congratulated himself on having played his part so well. He rejoiced that he was able to take his place once again in the national conflict and began to establish contact with his leaders. It was at that moment that a terrible burning doubt flashed through his mind. Perhaps he had never deceived anybody, neither his jailers, nor his fellow prisoners, nor even himself. Where would the game end? Here once again we had to reassure the patient and to free him from the burden of guilt. Psychiatric symptoms encountered. A. Phobia of all collective discussion. As soon as three or four people came together, the inhibition made its appearance again, and mistrust and reticence weighed heavily upon those present. B. The impossibility of explaining and defending any given position. Thought proceeds by antithetic couplings. Everything that is affirmed can, at the same instant, be denied with the same force. This is certainly the most painful sequel that we encountered in this war. An obsessional personality is the fruit of the, quote, psychological action used in the service of colonialism in Algeria. 2. For non-intellectuals. In centers such as that at Boragia, subjectivity is not taken as the starting point for modifying the attitude of the individual. On the contrary, the body is dealt with. It is broken in the hope that national consciousness will thus be demolished. It is a thorough breaking in. Rewards are taken to mean the absence of torture or the possibility of getting food to eat. A. You must declare that you do not belong to the FLN. You must shout this out in groups. You must repeat it for hours on end. B. After that, you must recognize that you were once in the FLN and that you have come to realize that it was a bad thing. Thus, down with the FLN. After this stage, we come to another. The future of Algeria is French. It can be nothing other than French. Without France, Algeria will go back to the Middle Ages. Finally, you are French. Long live France. Here, the disorders met with are not serious. It is the painful, suffering body that calls for rest and peace. Series D. Psychosomatic disorders. A marked increase in mental disorders and the creation of conditions favorable to the development of specific morbid phenomena are not the only consequences of the colonial war in Algeria. Quite apart from the pathology of torture, there flourishes in Algeria a pathology of atmosphere, a state which leads medical practitioners to say when confronted with a case which they cannot understand, quote, "This will all be cleared up when this damn war is over." We propose to group together in this fourth series the illnesses met with among Algerians, some of whom were interned in concentration camps. The main characteristic of these illnesses is that they are of the psychosomatic type. The name, psychosomatic pathology, is given to the general body of organic disorders, the development of which is favored by a conflicting situation. The name psychosomatic is used because the determinism is psychic in origin. This pathology is considered as a means whereby the organism responds to, in other words, adapts itself to, the conflict it is faced with, the disorder being at the same time a symptom and a cure. More precisely, it is generally conceded that the organism, once again we are speaking of the cortico-visceral unity, the psychosomatic unity of former times, resolves the conflict by an unsatisfactory but on the whole economical means. The organism, in fact, chooses the lesser evil in order to avoid catastrophe. On the whole, this pathology is very well known today, although the different therapeutic methods proposed, relaxation and suggestion, for example, seem to us very uncertain. In the Second World War in England, during the air raids and in the Soviet Union among the besieged populations of towns, notably in Stalingrad, there was a great increase in reports of the occurrence of such disorders. Today, we know very well that it is not necessary to be wounded by a bullet in order to suffer from the fact of war, in body as well as in mind. Like all other wars, the Algerian War has created its contingent of cortico-visceral illnesses. With the exception of Group G, described below, all the disorders met with in Algeria have already been described during the course of, quote, traditional wars. Group G seems to us to be specific to the colonial war in Algeria. This particular form of pathology, a generalized muscular contraction, has already called forth attention before the revolution began. But the doctors described it by portraying it as a congenital stigma of the native and, quote, original part of his nervous system, where it was stated it was possible to find the proof of a predominance of the extra pyramidal system in the native. This contracture is in fact simply the postural accompaniment to the native's reticence, the expression in muscular form of his rigidity and his refusal with regard to colonial authority. Psychiatric symptoms encountered. A. Stomach ulcers. Very numerous. The pains are felt predominantly at night, with considerable vomiting, loss of weight, sadness, and moroseness, and irritability in exceptional cases. It should be noted that the majority of these patients are very young, from 18 to 25 years old. As a general rule, we never advise surgical intervention. A gastrectomy was performed on two occasions, and in these two same cases, a second intervention was necessary in the same year as the first. B. Nephritic colic. Here again we find pains, which came on intensely at night. Obviously stones are hardly ever present. These colics may occur, though rarely in patients from 14 to 16 years old. C. Menstruation trouble in women. This pathology is very well known, and we shall not spend much time on it. Either the women affected remain 3 or 4 months without menstruation, or else considerable pain accompanies it, which has repercussions on character and conduct. D. Intense sleeplessness caused by idiopathic tremors. The patients are young adults to whom all rest is denied because of a generalized slight shaking, reminiscent of a total case of Parkinson's disease. Here, too, scientific thinkers could invoke an extra pyramidal determinism. D. Hair turning white early. Among the survivors of the interrogation centers, the hair often turns white suddenly, either in patches, in certain areas, or totally. Very often, this is accompanied by serious debility and sexual impotence. F. Paroxysmal tachycardias. The cardiac rhythm accelerates abruptly, 120, 130, or 140 per minute. These tachycardias are accompanied by anxiety and by an impression of imminent death. The end of the crisis is marked by a heavy sweating fit. G. Generalized contraction with muscular stiffness. These symptoms are found in patients of the masculine sex who find it increasingly difficult. In two cases, the appearance of the symptoms was abrupt, to execute certain movements, going upstairs, walking quickly, or running. The cause of this difficulty lies in a characteristic rigidity, which inevitably reminds us of the impairing of certain regions of the brain, central gray nuclei. It is an extended rigidity, and walking is performed with small steps. The passive flexion of the lower limbs is almost impossible. No relaxation can be achieved. The patient seems to be made all of a piece, subjected, as he is, to a sudden contraction, and incapable of the slightest voluntary relaxation. The face is rigid, but expresses a marked degree of bewilderment. The patient does not seem to, quote, release his nervous tension. He is constantly tense, waiting between life and death. Thus, one of these patients said to us, quote, you see, I'm already stiff like a dead man. Criminal impulses found in North Africans which have their origin in the National War of Liberation. It is not only necessary to fight for the liberty of your people. You must also teach that people once again, and first learn once again yourself, what is the full stature of a man, and this you must do for as long as the fight lasts. You must go back into history, that history of men damned by other men, and you must bring about and render possible the meeting of your people and other men. In reality, the soldier who is engaged in armed combat in a national war deliberately measures from day to day the sum of all the degradation inflicted upon man by colonial oppression. The man of action has sometimes the exhausting impression that he must restore the whole of his people, that he must bring every one of them up out of the pit and out of the shadows. He very often sees that his task is not only to hunt down the enemy forces, but also to overcome the kernel of despair which has hardened in the native's being. The period of oppression is painful, but the conflict, by reinstating the downtrodden, sets on foot a process of reintegration which is fertile and decisive in the extreme. A people's victorious fight not only consecrates the triumph of its rights, it also gives to that people consistency, coherence, and homogeneity. For colonialism has not simply depersonalized the individual it has colonized. This depersonalization is equally felt in the collective sphere, on the level of social structures. The colonized people find that they are reduced to a body of individuals who only find cohesion when in the presence of the colonizing nation. The fight carried on by a people for its liberation leads it, according to circumstances, either to refuse or else to explode the so-called truths which have been established in its consciousness by the colonial civil administration, by the military occupation, and by economic exploitation. Armed conflict alone can really drive out these falsehoods created in man, which force into inferiority the most lively minds among us, and which literally mutilate us. How many times in Paris, in Algiers, or in Basse-Terre have we not heard men from the colonized countries violently protesting against the pretended laziness of the black man, of the Algerian, and of the Vietnamese? And yet, is it not the simple truth that under the colonial regime, a fellah who is keen on his work or a Negro who refuses to rest are nothing but pathological cases? The native's laziness is the conscious sabotage of the colonial machine. On the biological plane, it is a remarkable system of auto protection, and in any case, it is a sure break upon the seizure of the whole country by the occupying power. The resistance that forests and swamps present to foreign penetration is the natural ally of the native. His point of view must be understood. It is time to stop remonstrating and declaring that the nigger is a great worker and that the Arab is a first rate at clearing ground. Under the colonial regime, what is true for the Arab and for the Negro is that they should not lift their little fingers, nor in the slightest degree help the oppressor to sink his claws deeper into his prey. The duty of the native, who has not yet reached maturity in political consciousness and decided to hurl back oppression, is literally to make it so that the slightest gesture has to be torn out of him. This is a very concrete manifestation of non-cooperation, or at least of minimum cooperation. These observations, which concern the relations between the native and his work, could equally be applied to the respect the native has for the oppressor's laws, to the regular payment of rates and taxes, and to the relations which the native has with the colonial system. Under the colonial regime, gratitude, sincerity, and honor are empty words. During the last few years, I have had occasion to verify a very classic fundamental idea, that honor, dignity, and respect for the given word can only manifest themselves in the framework of national and international homogeneity. From the moment that you and your like are liquidated like so many dogs, you have no other resource but to use all and every means to regain your importance as a man. You must therefore weigh as heavily as you can upon the body of your torturer, in order that his soul, lost in some byway, may finally find once more its universal dimension. During these last years, I have had occasion to see that in wartime Algeria, honor, self-sacrifice, love of life, and scorn of death have taken on no ordinary forms. There is no question of singing the praises of those who are fighting. We are concerned here with a very ordinary statement, which even the most rabid colonialists have not failed to make. The fighting Algerian has an unusual manner of fighting and dying, and no reference to Islam or to paradise can explain that generous dedication of self when there is question of defending his people or shielding his brothers. And then there is that overwhelming silence, but of course the body cries out, that silence that overwhelms the torturer. Let us admit, here we find again that very ancient law which forbids any element whatsoever to remain unmoved when the nation has begun to march, when man affirms and claims at the same time his limitless humanity. Among the characteristics of the Algerian people, as observed by colonialism, we will particularly notice their appalling criminality. Before 1954, magistrates, policemen, barristers, journalists, and legal doctors agreed unanimously that criminality in Algeria was a problem. It was affirmed that the Algerian was a born criminal. A theory was elaborated, and scientific proofs were found to support it. This theory was taught in the universities for over 20 years. Algerian medical students received this education, and imperceptibly, after accommodating themselves to colonialism, the elite came also to accommodate themselves to the inherent stigma of the Algerian people. They were born slackers, born liars, born robbers, and born criminals. We propose here to repeat this official's theory and to recall to mind the concrete basis and the scientific arguments used to create it. Later on, we shall go over the facts and try to reinterpret them. The Algerian frequently kills other men. It is a fact. The magistrates will tell you that 4/5 of cases brought to court deal with blows and woundings. The proportion of criminality in Algeria is one of the heaviest and largest in the world, or so they affirm. There are no minor delinquencies. When the Algerian, and this applies equally to all North Africans, puts himself outside the law, it is always outside to the maximum. The Algerian kills savagely. First, the favorite weapon is the knife. The magistrates, quote, who know the country, have created a minor philosophy on this subject. The Kabyles, for example, prefer a pistol or a gun. The Arabs of the plain have a preference for the knife. Certain magistrates wonder if the Algerian has not an inner need for the sight of blood. The Algerian, you are told, needs to feel warm blood and to bathe in the blood of his victim. These magistrates, policemen, and doctors hold serious dissertations on the relationship between the Muslim soul and blood. A certain number of magistrates go so far as to say that the reason why an Algerian kills a man is primarily and above all in order to slit his throat. The savagery of the Algerian shows itself especially in the number of wounds he inflicts, some of these being unnecessary once the victim has been killed. Autopsies establish one fact incontestably. The murderer gives the impression, by inflicting many wounds of equal deadlines, that he wished to kill an incalculable number of times. The Algerian kills for no reason. Very frequently, magistrates and policemen are nonplussed by the motives of a murder. It may arise out of a gesture, an allusion, an ambiguous statement, a quarrel over an olive tree which is possessed in common, or an animal which is strayed by an eighth of an acre. Confronted by such a murder, sometimes by a double or triple murder, the looked-for cause and the expected motive, which would justify or give grounds for these murders, is finally found to be of disappointing triviality. From thence springs the frequent impression that the social group is hiding the real motives. Finally, robbery, as practiced by an Algerian, is always coupled with housebreaking, whether accompanied or not by manslaughter, and in any case with aggression against the owner. All these elements which cluster around Algerian criminality have appeared to specify its nature sufficiently clearly to enable a tentative systematization to be built up. Similar, though somewhat less weighty, observations were made in Tunisia and Morocco, and thus the question shifted more and more onto the ground of North African criminality. For over 30 years, under the constant direction of Professor Perrault, professor of psychiatry on the faculty of Algiers, several teams worked with the aim of specifying the forms of expression of this criminality and of establishing a sociological, functional, and anatomical interpretation for them. We shall here quote the main works on this subject by the psychiatric school of the faculty of Algiers. The conclusions of the researchers carried on for over 20 years were, let us recall to mind, the subject of authoritative lectures from the chair of psychiatry. It is thus that Algerian doctors who are graduates of the faculty of Algiers are obliged to hear and learn that the Algerian is born a criminal. Moreover, I remember certain among us who in all sincerity upheld and developed these theories that we had learned. We even add, quote, it's a hard pill to swallow, but it's been scientifically established. The North African is a criminal. His predatory instinct is well known. His intense aggressivity is visible to the naked eye. The North African likes extremes, so we can never entirely trust him. Today he is the best of friends, tomorrow the worst of enemies. He is insensible to shades of meaning, and Cartesianism is fundamentally foreign to him. The sense of balance, the weighing and pondering of an opinion or action, clashes with his most intimate nature. The North African is a violent person, of a hereditary violence. We find him incapable of self-discipline or of canalizing his impulses. Yes, the Algerian is a congenital impulsive. But we must be precise. This impulsiveness is largely aggressive and generally homicidal. It is in this fashion that we come to explain the unorthodox behavior of the Algerian, who is a prey to melancholia. The French psychiatrists in Algeria found themselves faced with a difficult problem. They were accustomed, when dealing with a patient subject to melancholia, to fear that he would commit suicide. Now, the melancholic Algerian takes to killing. This illness of the moral consciousness, which is always accompanied by auto-accusation and auto-destructive tendencies, took on, in the case of Algerians, hetero-destructive forms. The melancholic Algerian does not commit suicide, he kills. This is the homicidal melancholia, which has been thoroughly studied by Professor Perrault in the thesis of his pupil, Montserrat. How did the Algerian school deal with such an anomaly? First, said the school of Algiers, killing oneself is a turning into and against oneself. It implies looking at oneself. It means practicing introspection. Now, the Algerian is not given to an inner life. There is no inner life where the North African is concerned. On the contrary, the North African gets rid of his worries by throwing himself on the people who surround him. He does not analyze. Since by definition melancholia is an illness of the moral conscience, it is clear that the Algerian can only develop pseudo-melancholia, since the precariousness of his conscience and the feebleness of his moral sense are well known. This incapacity on the part of the Algerian to analyze his situation and to organize a mental panorama is perfectly understandable if we refer to the two classes of causality set forth by French writers. First, we must notice intellectual aptitudes. The Algerian is strongly marked by mental debility. If we are to really understand this datum, we must go back to the semiology established by the Algerian school of psychiatry. The native, it is stated by them, presents the following characteristics: complete or almost complete lack of emotivity, credulous and susceptible to the extreme, persistent obstinacy, mental puerility without the spirit of curiosity found in the Western child, tendency to accidents and pithiatic reactions. The Algerian does not see the whole of the question. The question he asks himself always concerns the details and excludes all synthesis. He is a pointillist, clinging to objects, lost in details, insensible to ideas, and impervious to concepts. Verbal expression is reduced to a minimum. His actions are always impulsive and aggressive. He is incapable of grasping detail when looking at the whole, and he absolutizes the element and takes the part for the whole. Thus, he will have total reactions when confronted with particular incitements and with insignificant causes such as a fig tree or a gesture or a sheep on his land. His congenital aggressivity finds ways of expressing itself on the slightest pretext. It is a state of aggressivity in its purest form. Leaving the descriptive stage, the Algier school begins on that of explanation. It was in 1935 at the Congress of Mental Specialists and Neurologists that Professor Perrault defined the scientific basis of his theory. In the discussion that followed the report by Barak on hysteria, he pointed out that, quote, "the native of North Africa whose superior and cortical activities are only slightly developed is a primitive creature whose life, essentially vegetative and instinctive, is above all regulated by his diencephalon." In order to estimate the importance of this discovery of Professor Perrault's, we should remember that the characteristic of the human species when compared to other vertebrates is that it is corticalized. The diencephalon is one of the most primitive parts of the brain, and man is above all the vertebrae in which the cortex dominates. For Professor Perrault, the life of the native of North Africa is dominated by diencephalic urges. It is as much as to say that in a way the native North African is deprived of a cortex. Professor Perrault does not shrink from this contradiction, and in April 1939, in the Southern Medical and Surgical Gazette, he states precisely, in collaboration with his pupil Sutter, who is at present professor of psychiatry in Algiers, quote, "primitivism is not a lack of maturity or a marked stoppage in the development of the intellectual psychism. It is a social condition which has reached the limit of its evolution. It is logically adapted to a life different from ours." Finally, the professors come to the very basis of the doctrine. This primitivism is not merely a way of living which is the result of a special upbringing. It has much deeper roots. We even consider that it must have its substratum in a particular predisposition of the architectonic structure, or at least in the dynamic hierarchization of the nervous centers. We are in the presence of a coherent body of comportment and of a coherent life which can be explained scientifically. The Algerian has no cortex, or more precisely, he is dominated, like the inferior vertebrates, by the diencephalon. The cortical functions, if they exist at all, are very feeble, and are practically unintegrated into the dynamic of existence. There is thus neither mystery nor paradox. The hesitation of the colonist in giving responsibility to the native is not racism nor paternalism, but quite simply a scientific appreciation of the biologically limited possibilities of the native.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment down, we have one more to go, and we will be all done with Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. If folks have a final word, concluding thought that they want to get in with regards to the book, what they think of Fanon, if this was your first time being exposed to his work, you haven't read anything else of Fanon. If you want to give a thought, no, I've been critical. I think a few others have as well. Certainly, if we have any folks who've been listening and you think, hey, you know, I've been reading, I've been following, I learned a lot, I'm glad we read it. You all missed, you didn't understand, or you weren't reading closely enough to follow and appreciate what Fanon shared. If that person is out listening live, please share now, because this is our last week on the book. So we'd like to get that included before we move on next week. Just so people, if you want to prepare next week, our book, Neil Postman, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. That'll be our book for next week. That book is all about language and how the way people use words, either recklessly, whatever it is, or just not knowing, that can cause problems and even suggestions on how to remedy that. But really enjoyed that book. I've read it before. Neil Postman, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. That is an older book. I know Mr. Demery Ford mentioned it last week, trying to obtain. He found it difficult. Some other people may have as well. University libraries, I would say that would be the number one. I have not found a PDF copy online, but I'll continue to look. But if there's a major college or university in your area, check it out. I suspect their library might have it. That's where I read my original copy. I got it from the library, but I own a copy now. Anyway, if you'd like to participate, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The code 564-943-pound. The number again, 641-715-3640. If you want to join the conversation but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. The address, if you need it, is tinytiny.cc/oneRace. That is the number one. Address again, tinytiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you click that link, look on the left of the page. You'll see a link that says Free Vote Line. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. First line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for a code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom and you should be able to hear us. Same procedure if you would like to participate live. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. When you do so, you'll hear an audio prompt. Press the number one. We will get you on the line. folks who dialed in, if you have any commentary, again, this is our last session. France Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. Folks who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed. I think Mr. Demery Ford, the only hand. The other folks are spectating for the moment. But if folks have commentary, I'll keep an eye out. Mr. Demery Ford, any commentary you want to share?
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers, listeners. I'd like to start off with everything that you said. It seemed as though when we first started reading this book, I didn't like it very well. At first, I did not understand. I had to listen to the recording two or three times and actually throw myself into the words of the book to get some resemblance of understanding. And my tiny diencephalon was able to decipher some of these ideas and strategies and theories that he come up with. So I'm enjoying it a little more around the end. I am excited about this being the end. And with all that said, I'd like to not attack Mr. Fanon, but to bring up some points that the reading seems to point to some involvement by Mr. Fanon. The reason why I say that is out of the categories of the tortured individuals that came to the medical center, you know, those that know something, well, they're seldom seen at the medical center. So if you know something, you probably were sent to one of those other interrogation centers where you were tortured beyond belief. And two, those who know nothing, if they're not beaten by the police roundup, they often come to them to consult them. So, and then they said that the ones that they knew was tortured, they very seldom saw them. And then I think that the medical centers was part of their torture plan. The reason why I say that, they said that if a Algerian rebel confessed, you're killed immediately. If you don't confess, you're beaten and tortured day in and day out for months. Even if it's clear that you don't know anything, the book pointed out, no inspector or interrogator would just say, oh, give him another round there. Beat him up a little more there so he won't talk. He won't be able to say anything when he leaves. And so that's the attitude that they had, same attitude that the French woman's father had. He was get so excited about torturing Algerians that he couldn't eat or sleep. That's all he thought about. And unless I'm misinformed, Gus, you can correct me or anyone else on the line, the Algerians, although it's a part of Africa, they're not heavily melanated people. They seem to be a mix of ancestry. I guess the Berbers, Moors, Muslims that were previously in Spain that ended up back in Northern Africa. And I think that they probably have some Arab and Turkish ancestry. They're lighter complexion, non-black, non-white people. So if we can understand that, then the way the whites looked at them, they were subhuman, just as the way that they looked at black people and other Arab individuals. But France Fanon married a French, well, this is a question. Did he marry a French white woman, even after he experienced the horrors of the Algerian people. And it just seemed like it would be logical if he was over there and he's working, he sympathized with the people, he might fall in love with one of the native Algerian women. The reason why I asked that. But then, did he participate in the torture of innocent people since doctors had to administer the sodium pentothal that was used, the truth serum? The exact amount had to be given. And then the way he wrote about it, saying that, well, I guess it's kind of the history of sodium pentothal, is they started using it as medicine for anesthesia or pregnant women. And then they found it wasn't practical. So the military and police units started to use this chemical to get people. And then he gave some scientific explanation, like it would remove inhibitions and the fear of reprisal. But you would not know what you had said. Your memory was wiped out, you know, after the injection. So any questions or any information that you had given him would create such an anxiety that it would cause mental abnormality. And other torture, to speak briefly on the torture methods, besides the injections, which are still used today, those torture tactics of making them stand with their palms up, and they would hit them at the slightest movement. If you look on the Abu Ghraib photos, those people that were imprisoned by the United States and was tortured over there, they have the same techniques, a guy standing on a chair with his palms out like that. He's got a black hood on, but it's wires attached to him. So every time he moved, they give him that shock. So he's still using that today to torture, rape, sodomy, even murder. So when they torture these people, a lot of them wasn't seen anymore. Now on page 212, I think this shows further culpability of French whites and other confused non-white people that they could enlist through civil or military means, the doctors, and maybe even himself, where he gives this little tidbit where he's talking to a victim. I am a doctor, not a policeman. I'm here to help you. Thus, the prisoner's trust is won after a few days. Then, I'm going to give you a few shots to clear your head. For several days, all kinds of vitamins, heart stimulants, and other placebos are administered. On the fourth or fifth day, the sodium pentothal is injected intravenously, and the interrogation began. So, for him to know the intricate details of that, it seemed like he may have been involved in that. And it may have been willingly or unwillingly. It may have been his job to do that. But the one other interesting thing was the way that they treated the intellectuals, the way the brainwashing that they did, if I can coin Spike Lee's phrase, bamboozle and hoodwink the intellectual, playing the game of collaborator, then using him as an informant. And even after the symptomatic way of conditioning his condition of his state of mind, even after he's released, the damage is reflected in the way that he looks at it and justifies his act. Even after he went through this brainwashing and was released from captive, they have to, you know, follow up on him. And if he starts to have these guilts, I guess, I'm just guessing, the way they free him from his burden of guilt is more injections of sodium pentothal. But I can say a couple other things, but that center that he mentioned in Barugia, it has since been turned into a prison, and recent events, I think as recent as 2011 or 12 or so, they had supposedly a massacre at this place. So a lot of this stuff is still going on. Now, I wanted to talk about some of the symptoms, but I'll mute the line and give somebody else a chance. I want to come back and talk about some of the symptoms of people that were tortured and the effects of it. I'll do my line for now. Thanks, sir.
For sure. In terms of Frantz Fanon's wife, my understanding, his wife, Josie, she was a French white woman. Now, they, you know, could have met elsewhere. Her being a French white woman just means that in all likelihood she was born in France. But, you know, she could have been hanging out in Algiers when they met. It seems that she died in Algiers. So it seems that she did some traveling, but it seems that he did indeed marry a white French woman. I also thought that was a speculation in terms of how Fanon came to get that knowledge about the administration of sodium pentothal, how that was used for folks that were going to be tortured, and how the medical staffer, I guess, would come in and lie to him, and like, oh, I'm not a police officer, and, you know, we're going to give you this to try and calm you down, and then give him this quote-unquote truth serum, I guess, down the road, and then allow the interrogation to begin. How would he get that information? Was he enlisted to do this? And then sharing, good question. Folks can search on that if they are so inclined. Let's see. If other folks have commentary, if you have a hand or thoughts you want to get in, hand up, since this is our last session, anything you would like to share. Some of the things that stood out over the last section that we read, or the portion that we read today, rather, the same thing that Mr. Demery noted, this to me didn't seem antiquated when he's listing out all these different torture techniques. If anything, I was reminded of Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard. Full title, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture, that we read earlier this year, when he's talking about one of the torture methods is, I think, A, was injection of water by mouth accompanied by an enema of soapy water given at high pressure. And then the next one is introduction of a bottle into the anus. A lot of this just to me seems very homoerotic. That I have, and I think the same thing we talked about all throughout Delectable Negro, ways of consuming non-white bodies, sexually exploiting non-white bodies, and a lot of this homoerotic behavior, a lot of the electric shock punishment that was used here, that didn't, or Abu Ghraib, certainly, Mr. Demerfour is 1,000% accurate, but it reminded me, stateside in Chicago, I thought they just had, you know, all that commentary about what they were doing, Police Chief John Burge, who was never prosecuted for torturing black people exclusively. I think that was one of their prime methods of torture, was using some sort of electrical prod or shock, specifically on the genitals of black inmates in Chicago. It just seems like they carry out a lot of these same sadistic practices worldwide, and particularly when they can get any opportunity where they can get some black people caged behind closed doors where nobody will see it, and then they can carry out all their sadistic sexual fantasies with black bodies. Let's see what else stood out. I don't, when I was going through and hearing all of these descriptions, because it seemed like this took up pretty much the bulk of what we read this week, I don't know how enthused I would be. I remember when we read Medical Apartheid and everyone said, wow, this is gruesome. Great book, top five, loved it. But I remember a lot of people saying that, you know, it was kind of gruesome reading, hearing about that. This certainly is gruesome. And I don't recall too often when people talk about this book with glee, I don't recall them mentioning this part. This is very graphic. This is not some abstract violence of striking back at a white colonialist. This is not some abstract talking about the need or why it's beneficial for black people to use violence. This is, hey, these are the people who have scientifically studied violence and scientifically studied torturing people and the best method to go about torturing people to extract information. That's what this seems like to me, that these folks have extraordinary codification and glee around violence. I love this even more than being with my wife. I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned that. That was from last week, though. But right in the same section where he's talking to some of the white colonial officials, I don't hear that mentioned. That to me would stand out in a gargantuan manner. Like, wow, peaceful. I mean, if we're talking about violence, again, cue Mr. Nero, white people kill for fun. This seems, I mean, beyond sadistic, beyond psychopathic. Bobby E. Wright, Psychopathic Racial Personality, other essays, top book as well. Other things that stood out, the portion a little later on where he talks about some of the results of all this torture, some of the symptoms that you see, and he says, this was B, intellectual or sensory perception is clouded. The patient cannot affirm the existence of a given visible object. Reasoning is assimilated, but in undifferentiated fashion. There is a fundamental inability to distinguish between true and false. Everything is true and everything is false at the same time. That sort of paralyzed thinking, total result of racism, white supremacy, as he points out. I think you see a lot of those same behaviors right now, where you have non-white people that just end up being in a total state of confusion. You just kind of end up going along with whatever racists say about how things are going to operate. In fact, it reminded me, that portion reminded me a lot of another book we read, George Orwell's 1984, way back. I think that was in 2013 that we read that text. But the thing where I think towards the end, the climax, where they tell the main character, what is it? You know, sometimes two is five, sometimes two is six, sometimes two and two is one. Sometimes two and two is eight, you know, and sometimes it's all of them. It's whatever we say it is. It reminds me a lot of that line, which, again, racist white supremacists, when you have a system that is dominated by deception and lies, you're going to have a lot of that, just getting people totally disoriented. And particularly when you can apply direct violence and torture, they will say whatever you want. And a lot of that stuff, you know, it's going to be a lifelong psychological injury. The pervasive fear, that is what the system of white supremacy is designed to produce, to just have people in consumed with fear so that they are paralyzed. You can't think correctly. If you can't think correctly, it's going to be difficult for you to act in a correct, constructive manner. Let's see. Session on brainwashing. I thought that was important as well. The portion, this is in the brainwashing section, where he says, this is the last part of that section, to be alone is an act of rebellion. So the intellectual is always with somebody. Silence is also forbidden. Thinking must be done aloud. Very interesting. Reminded me of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and the importance that she attached to having quiet. Even in fact, she talked about that a lot. Another psychiatrist that we've heard a lot from, where she talked about the importance of having quiet time so you can think and make observations, like what Fanon is doing, thinking about his patients or the environment that he's in. He takes a quiet environment so that you can think and study. And he's saying it seems to be we want the opposite of that for people that are being persecuted and attacked. We don't want a whole lot of thinking. If you're going to be doing any thinking, you got to do that out loud so we can monitor what it is you are saying. Where even the intellectual is always with somebody. That even, to me, stands out for some reason. But I thought that was significant as well. Let's see. Double check to make sure. Folks that are listening and have other commentary, you should get a hand up now before we get to the second audio segment. Double checking to make sure I didn't miss any of my other notes. Yeah, just a lot of this, even though it's not colonialism, a lot of these symptoms seem like things that non-white people worldwide would have to varying degrees throughout the system of white supremacy. When he's talking about later on some of the symptoms being menstruation trouble in women, I think having all sorts of birth defects, fertility issues, I think all of that is going to be a problem because we're under so much stress. Dorothy Roberts talked about that in her book, Healing the Black Body. She's been a guest on the program. While I'm still checking through, Mr. Demery Ford, do you have any other notes, anything else that stood out from the first audio segment you want to make sure you got in?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, where you stopped off, some of the effects of this torturing, the gastrectomy was conducted twice, and each time we had to reoperate within a year. You know, a kid, you know, I guess he's between 18 and 25 years old, and then the symptoms that he was having were psychosomatic in nature. You know, what I'm thinking is they knew what was wrong with this guy. You had to. If you are a psychiatrist and you know these effects happen to people, and this is exactly what's going on with this guy, why would you take out part of his stomach and then create an even worse situation because it was psychosomatic? Now he's got smaller room in his for his stomach to make these adjustments. You know, he's so traumatized. And then the renal colic, you know, similar to kidney stone. I've had people to tell me that kidney stone is some of the worst pain you could ever experience in your life. And if you're not treated immediately, I guess you could die, but you know, the horrific pain he talked about, the guy told me, it's just horrific beyond, you know, what you can stand. And this is what these kids were going through with their heart rates going up to 140 beats a minute. You know, you could just die from fear, you know, impressions of intimate death, your heart just beating like a lab rat. And one that was important, the systematic contraction, the muscle stiffness. You know, imagine that. I mean, you've been tortured and your mind has been screwed with so much that you can hardly, I think somewhere it said, you're like a piece of wood. He couldn't relax. And, you know, that's a symptom of victims in America. We cannot relax. You know, we are in a constant state of stress. And stress is really, it will deceive you. You'll say, oh, I'm not stressed. But I've been retired now for a couple of years. It has taken me, it took probably a whole year before some of these same symptoms, you know, like the stiffness and just, oh man, I was just racked with pain behind the stress of 30 years of government service. We won't go into that. I wanted to bring up, before we go, this part where he was talking about we're supposed to, he said, as soon as you and your fellow man are cut down like dogs, there's no other solution but to use every means available to reestablish your weight as a human being. You must therefore weigh as heavily as possible on your torturer's body, so that his wits, which have wandered off somewhere, can at last be restored to their human dimension. You know, I don't know how he came to that conclusion, but we as victims need to stop trying to bring white people to a realization of what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. This is all scientific. Why would he write something like this and he just giving you scientific means of torture and destroying people's lives psychosomatically? And then talking about, then they go into the, you know, describing the other, because you have to alienate the person or the people so that you can do these atrocities to them without any feeling of guilt. So they continue to talk about how Algerians were senseless killers. And, you know, the motives of what they talk about is murder at the slightest gesture, an allusion or ambiguous remark, quarrels over the ownership of an olive tree or an animal that has strayed a few feet. You know, as non-white black people, we take on symptoms like that. Our teenagers are killing each other in the street. You know, I go to the supermarket. Black people almost run over me with the cart. I try to be as courteous as I can. I recite Gus's prayer in my mind all the time, because these people force you to have to do that. It's a lot of anti-blackness going on. It's just we're just victims of the environment. He spoke of the environment. The Algerians were in an environment that would sustain and enhance insanity or mental illness. And it was surprising that he mentioned that diencephalon, which is a region of the brain that includes the pineal gland, which whites have an abnormality on. And, you know, that's one of their tricks. They want to, whatever is afflicting them or that is their problem, they want to project that off onto someone else and then provide scientific facts to back it up. And I think that, you know, besides that, Professor Perot and his pseudo scientific BS, because everyone knows if you're melancholic, then you're not, that does not, you would probably kill yourself before you would go out and kill somebody. That's kind of common knowledge. So why would he say differently and then try to back that up? It's just another way to stomp on non-white people and victimize them. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For I think also to your earlier point about the Algerians, I think these folks generally, I think if you saw a photograph of some of the people there, and I mean you're talking about a large number of people, but I think in general, the people that populate that area phenotypically are lighter. They have less melanin than folks that you would be thinking about in the Sudan or other regions. Just generally speaking, that is the northern part of Africa. The folks, if you know differently, you should speak up. The caller at last four digits, 5771, 5771. Did you have commentary? You should be with us.
Temper?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Green Gus, greetings to all the callers and listeners. This, I guess this part of the book is a little bit, you know, just a little bit more relevant to racism. Not too much, but, you know, I'm kind of in agreement with majority of the book not being relevant to you know, the system of racism and how we solve this problem. But, you know, I do appreciate a little bit of the text that we read previously in regards to the brainwashing. It seems like the brainwashing was a very relevant point in this one, which can be something that is something that's going on today, not in the sense of torturing, but brainwashing in other ways within the system, you know, through entertainment and all the eight areas of human activity. But we also, what also was important, and Mr. Demery Four, and you brought it out about the part from the criminal impulsiveness of the North African part, and how this Professor Perot wanted to scientifically, with the scientific racism, show how the Algerian people were inferior. And talk about biologically how they're criminals, and you know how they just like to kill and everything like that. But what's interesting is, you know, I was looking up this this Professor Perot, you know, online, and found out that he has a son Maurice Perot, who basically became a psychiatrist, followed in his father's footsteps, and was continuing teaching psychiatry in Algiers up until 1962. So the son continued the father's racist practice and up until 1962. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And apparently, according to this website that I pulled up, he was teaching until 1982 at some place named Clermont-Ferrand. So scientific racism being passed down from father to son. So, I mean, that's all I have for now. I'll be my line.
Great point. Lothrop Stoddard, they have lots of generations of that being able to come up. J.B. Watson, I think, is another. Lots of generations of that with eugenics to say that black people are super predators, they're criminals, and we need to get something to electrocute their genitals right now. Any other folks that are listening, if you had commentary you wanted to get in, any last thoughts, anything stood out, since we are wrapping up Wretched of the Earth, you should do so now. Certainly we'll have one more audio segment, and then after that one, get our concluding thoughts in. If I do not see anyone else, I think I got at least all the comments in that I did for the moment. Make sure. Yeah, a lot of this, like I said, it just seems like the same type of things that you can expect from white people worldwide in terms of racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Even the use of the terms where he says the Algerian has no cortex, or more precisely, he is dominated like the inferior vertebrates by the diencephalon. The cortical functions, if they exist at all, are very feeble. Isn't that exactly what they said in justifying forced sterilizations? Feeble-minded. That's the only word people that know anything about eugenics and the Supreme Court case, I think, would carry about feeble-minded. They get down to even using the exact same terms, which in my view, important words direct linked to thought. A lot of times just using certain terms, they're already going to align you with a certain way of thinking and behavior where things will already start moving in the way you want just with the use of words. I'll stop there. If you have anything else you want to get in, just make a note, and we should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. We are finishing France Fanon's Wretched of the Earth today, our final audio segment before we move on. If you are getting something constructive, wonderful. If it has been a chore or laborsome to read, we're almost done. Last few pages, The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Let us end this review by seeking a summing up, which takes the whole of Africa for its field, from Dr. A. Carruthers, an expert from the World Health Organization. This international expert brought together the essentials of his observations in a book which was published in 1954. Dr. Carruthers' work was carried on in Central and East Africa, but his conclusions form a group with those of the North African school. For in fact, the international expert states, quote, "The African makes very little use of his frontal lobes. All the particularities of African psychiatry can be put down to frontal laziness." In order to make his point clearer, Dr. Carruthers establishes a very lively comparison. He puts forward the idea that the normal African is a, quote, "lobotomized European." We know that the Anglo-Saxon school believed that they had found a radical cure for certain serious forms of mental illness by practicing dissection of an important part of the brain. Since then, however, the establishment of the fact that this method seriously impaired the personality has led to its being abandoned. According to Dr. Carruthers, the likeness existing between the normal African native and the lobotomized European is striking. Dr. Carruthers, having studied the works of different authors working in Africa, offers us a conclusion which is the basis of a uniform conception of the African. He writes, "Such are the given facts of the case which do not concern European categories. They have been gathered in different regions of East, West, and South Africa, and on the whole, each author had little or no knowledge of the work of the others. The essential similarity of these researches is therefore quite remarkable." We should point out before concluding that Dr. Carruthers defined the Mau Mau revolt as the expression of an unconscious frustration complex whose reoccurrence could be scientifically avoided by spectacular psychological adaptations. So it was that unusual behavior, the African's frequent criminality, the triviality of his motives, the murderous and always very bloody nature of his brawls, raised a problem in observers' minds. The proposed explanation, which has come to be taught as a subject in the university, seems in the last analysis to be the following. The layout of the cerebral structures of the North African are responsible both for the native's laziness, for his intellectual and social inaptitude, and for his almost animal impulsivity. The criminal impulses of the North African are the transcription into the nature of his behavior of a given arrangement of the nervous system. It is a reaction which is neurologically understandable and written into the nature of things, of the thing which is biologically organized. The lack of integration of the frontal lobes in the cerebral dynamic is the explanation of the African's laziness, of his crimes, his robberies, his rapes, and his lies. It was a sub-prefect, who has now become a prefect, who voiced the conclusion to me. Quote, "We must counter these natural creatures," he said, "who obey the laws of their nature blindly with a strict, relentless ruling class. We must tame nature, not convince it. Discipline, training, mastering, and today pacifying are the words most frequently used by the colonialists in occupied territories. If we have spent a long time in going over the theories held by colonialist scientists, it was less with the intention of showing their poverty and absurdity than of raising a very important theoretical and practical problem. In fact, Algerian criminality only represented a subsection of the questions which were raised by the revolution, which could be reasoned out on the level of political discussion and demystification. But it so happens that the talks which formed the subject of this theme, were so fruitful that they allowed us to understand and discern more deeply the idea of social and individual liberation. When, in revolutionary practice, the question of Algerian criminality is raised in the presence of leaders and militants, when the average figures of crimes, misdemeanors, and robberies are cited for the period before the revolution, when it is explained that the nature of a crime or the frequency of offenses depends on the relations which exist between men and women and between persons and the state, and when everybody understands this, when we see before us the breaking up of the idea of the Algerian or the North African who is a criminal by vocation, an idea which was equally implanted into the consciousness of the Algerian, because after all, quote, "we're a quick-tempered, rowdy, bad lot. That's the way it is." Then it can be said for sure that the revolution is making progress. The important theoretical problem is that it is necessary at all times and in all places to make explicit, to demystify, and to harry the insult to mankind that exists in oneself. There must be no waiting until the nation has produced new men. There must be no waiting until men are imperceptibly transformed by revolutionary processes and perpetual renewal. It is quite true that these two processes are essential, but consciousness must be helped. The application of revolutionary theory, if it is to be completely liberating and particularly fruitful, exacts that nothing unusual should exist. One feels with particular force the necessity to totalize the event, to draw everything after one, to settle everything, to be responsible for everything. Now, conscience no longer boggles at going back into the past, or at marking time, if it is necessary. This is why, in the progress made by a fighting unit over a piece of ground, the end of an ambush does not mean rest, but rather is the signal for consciousness to take another step forward, for everything ought to keep pace together. Yes, the Algerian of his own accord accepts the verdict of the magistrates and the policemen. So we had to take this Algerian criminality, which was experienced on the narcissistic level as a manifestation of authentic virility, and place the problem on the level of colonial history. For example, we had to show that the criminal tendencies of Algerians in France differed fundamentally from those of the Algerians who were submitted to exploitation, which was directly colonial. A second thing ought to be noticed. In Algeria, Algerian criminality takes place in practice inside a closed circle. The Algerians rob each other, cut each other up, and kill each other. In Algeria, the Algerian rarely attacks Frenchmen and avoids brawls with the French. In France, on the other hand, the emigrant creates an intersocial and intergroup criminality. In France, Algerian criminality is diminishing. It is directly, especially at the French, and its motives are radically new. A certain paradox has helped us considerably in demystifying the militants. It has been established that since 1954, there has almost been a disappearance of crimes in common law. There are no more disputes and no longer any insignificant details which entail the death of a man. There are no longer explosive outbursts of rage because my wife's forehead or her left shoulder was seen by my neighbor. The national conflict seems to have canalized all anger and nationalized all affective or emotional movements. The French judges and barristers had already observed this, but the militant had to be made conscious of it. He had to be brought to understand the reasons for it. It remains for us to give the explanation. Should it be said that war, that privileged expression of an aggressivity which is at last made social, canalizes in the direction of the occupying power, all congenitally murderous acts. It is a commonplace that great social upheavals lessen the frequency of delinquency and mental disorders. This regression of Algerian criminality can thus be perfectly explained by the existence of a war which broke Algeria in two, and threw onto the side of the enemy the judicial and administrative machine. But in the countries of the Maghreb, which have already been liberated, this same phenomenon which was noticed during the conflicts for liberation continues to exist and even becomes more marked once independence is proclaimed. It would therefore seem that the colonial context is sufficiently original to give grounds for a reinterpretation of the causes of criminality. This is what we did for those on active service. Today, every one of us knows that criminality is not the consequence of the hereditary character of the Algerian, nor of the organization of his nervous system. The Algerian war, like all wars of national liberation, brings to the fore the true protagonist. In the colonial context, as we have already pointed out, the natives fight among themselves. They tend to use each other as a screen, and each hides from his neighbor, the national enemy. When, tired out after a hard 16-hour day, the native sinks down to rest on his mat, and a child on the other side of the canvas partition starts crying and prevents him from sleeping. It so happens that it is a little Algerian. When he goes to beg for a little semolina or a drop of oil from the grocer, to whom he already owes some hundreds of francs, and when he sees that he is refused, an immense feeling of hatred and an overpowering desire to kill rises within him. And the grocer is an Algerian. When, after having kept out of his way for weeks, he finds himself one day cornered by the Caid, who demands that he should pay, quote, his taxes, he cannot even enjoy the luxury of hating a European administrator. There before him is the Caid, who is the object of his hatred, and the Caid is an Algerian. The Algerian, exposed to temptations to commit murder every day, famine, eviction from his room because he has not paid the rent, the mother's dried up breasts, children like skeletons, the building yard which is closed down, the unemployed that hang about the foreman like crows, the native comes to see his neighbor as a relentless enemy. If he strikes his bare foot against a big stone in the middle of the path, it is the native who has placed it there, and the few olives that he was going to pick. X's children have gone and eaten in the night. For during the colonial period in Algeria and elsewhere, many things may be done for a couple of pounds of semolina. Several people may be killed over it. You need to use your imagination to understand that. Your imagination or your memory. In the concentration camps, men killed each other for a bit of bread. I remember one horrible scene. It was in Oran in 1944. From the camp where we were waiting to embark, soldiers were throwing bits of bread to little Algerian children who fought for them among themselves with anger and hate. Veterinary doctors can throw light on such problems by reminding us of the well-known, quote, peck order, which has been observed in farmyards. The corn, which is known to the hens, is in fact the object of relentless competition. Certain birds, the strongest, gobble up all the grains, while others who are less aggressive grow visibly thinner. Every colony tends to turn into a huge farmyard, where the only law is that of the knife. In Algeria, since the beginning of the War of National Liberation, everything has changed. the whole food stocks of a family, or a mekta, may in a single evening be given to a passing company. The family's only donkey may be lent to transport a wounded fighter, and when a few days later the owner learns of the death of his animal, which has been machine-gunned by an airplane, he will not begin threatening and swearing. He will not question the death of his donkey, but he will ask anxiously if the wounded man is safe and sound. Under the colonial regime, anything may be done for a loaf of bread or a miserable sheep. The relations of man with matter, with the world outside, and with history are in the colonial period simply relations with food. For a colonized man, in a context of oppression like that of Algeria, living does not mean embodying moral values or taking his place in the coherent and fruitful development of the world. To live means to keep on existing. Every date is a victory, not the result of work, but a victory felt as a triumph for life. Thus, to steal dates or to allow one sheep to eat the neighbor's grass is not a question of the negation of the property of others, nor the transgression of a law, nor lack of respect. These are attempts at murder. In order to understand that a robbery is not an illegal or an unfriendly action, but an attempt at murder, one must have seen in Kabylia men and women for weeks at a time going to get earth at the bottom of the valley and bringing it up in little baskets. The fact is that the only perspective is that belly which is more and more sunken, which is certainly less and less demanding, but which must be contented all the same. Who is going to take the punishment? The French are down in the plain with the police, the army, and the tanks. On the mountain, there are only Algerians. Up above, there is heaven, with the promise of a world beyond the grave. Down below, there are the French, with their very concrete promises of prison, beatings up, and executions. You are forced to come up against yourself. Here we discover the kernel of that hatred of self, which is characteristic of racial conflicts in segregated societies. The Algerian's criminality, his impulsivity, and the violence of his murders are therefore not the consequence of the organization of his nervous system or of characterial originality, but the direct product of the colonial situation. The fact that the soldiers of Algeria have discussed this problem, that they are not afraid of questioning the beliefs fostered among themselves by colonialism, that they understand that each man formed the screen for his neighbor, and that in reality each man committed suicide when he went for his neighbor. All these things should have primordial importance in the revolutionary conscience. Once again, the objective of the native who fights against himself is to bring about the end of domination, but he ought equally to pay attention to the liquidation of all untruths implanted in his being by oppression. Under a colonial regime such as existed in Algeria, the ideas put forward by colonialism not only influenced the European minority, but also the Algerians. Total liberation is that which concerns all sectors of the personality. The ambush or the attack, the torture or the massacre of his brothers plants more deeply the determination to win, wakes up the unwary, and feeds the imagination. When the nation stirs as a whole, the new man is not an a posteriori product of that nation. Rather, he coexists with and triumphs with it. This dialectic requirement explains the reticence with which adaptations of colonization and reforms of the facade are met. Independence is not a word which can be used as an exorcism, but an indispensable condition for the existence of men and women who are truly liberated. In other words, who are truly masters of all the material means which make possible the radical transformation of society. Conclusion. Come then, comrades. It would be as well to decide at once to change our ways. We must shake off the heavy darkness in which we were plunged and leave it behind. The new day which is already at hand must find us firm, prudent, and resolute. We must leave our dreams and abandon our old beliefs and friendships from the time before life began. Let us waste no time in sterile litanies and nauseating mimicry. Leave this Europe where they are never done talking of men, yet murder men everywhere they find them, at the corner of every one of their own streets, in all the corners of the globe. For centuries, they have stifled almost the whole of humanity in the name of a so-called spiritual experience. Look at them today swaying between atomic and spiritual disintegration. And yet it may be said that Europe has been successful in as much as everything that she has attempted has succeeded. Europe undertook the leadership of the world with ardor, cynicism, and violence. Look at how the shadow of her palaces stretches out ever further. Every one of her movement has burst the bounds of space and thought. Europe has declined all humility and all modesty, but she has also set her face against all solicitude and all tenderness. She has only shown herself parsimonious and niggardly where men are concerned. It is only men that she has killed and devoured. So, my brothers, how is it that we do not understand that we have better things to do than to follow that same Europe? That same Europe where they never are done talking of men, and where they never stop proclaiming that they were only anxious for the welfare of men. Today we know with what sufferings humanity has paid for every one of their triumphs of the mind. Come then, comrades. The European game has finally ended. We must find something different. We today can do everything, so as long as we do not imitate Europe, so long as we are not obsessed by the desire to catch up with Europe. Europe now lives at such a mad, reckless pace that she has shaken off all guidance and all reason, and she is running headlong into the abyss. We would do well to avoid it with all possible speed. Yet, it is very true that we need a model, that we want blueprints and examples. For many among us, the European model is the most inspiring. We have therefore seen in the preceding pages to what mortifying setbacks such an imitation has led us. European achievements, European techniques, and the European style ought no longer to tempt us and to throw us off our balance. When I search for man in the technique and the style of Europe, I see only a succession of negations of man and an avalanche of murders. The human condition, plans for mankind, and collaboration between men in those tasks which increase the sum total of humanity are new problems which demand true inventions. Let us decide not to imitate Europe. Let us combine our muscles and our brains in a new direction. Let us try to create the whole man whom Europe has been incapable of bringing to triumphant birth. 2 centuries ago, a former European colony decided to catch up with Europe. It succeeded so well that the United States of America became a monster, in which the taints, the sickness, and the inhumanity of Europe have grown to appalling dimensions. Comrades, have we not other work to do than to create a third Europe? The West saw itself as a spiritual adventure, It is in the name of the spirit, in the name of the spirit of Europe, that Europe has made her encroachments, that she has justified her crimes and legitimized the slavery in which she holds the four-fifths of humanity. Yes, the European spirit has strange roots. All European thought has unfolded in places which were increasingly more deserted and more encircled by precipices, and thus it was that the custom grew up in those places of very seldom meeting men. A permanent dialogue with oneself and an increasingly obscene narcissism never ceased to prepare the way for a half-delirious state where intellectual work became suffering and the reality was not at all that of a living man, working and creating himself, but rather words, different combination of words, and the tension springing from the meanings contained in the words. Yet some Europeans were found to urge the European workers to shatter this narcissism and to break with this unreality. But in general, the workers of Europe have not replied to these calls, for the workers believe, too, that they are part of the prodigious adventure of the European spirit. All the elements of a solution to the great problems of humanity have, at different times, existed in European thought. But the action of European men has not carried out the mission which fell to them and which consisted of bringing their whole weight violently to bear upon these elements, of modifying their arrangement and their nature, of changing them, and finally, of bringing the problem of mankind to an infinitely higher plane. Today, we are present at the stasis of Europe. Comrades, let us free from this motionless movement, where gradually dialectic is changing into the logic of equilibrium. Let us reconsider the question of mankind. Let us reconsider the question of cerebral reality and of the cerebral mass of all humanity, whose connections must be increased, whose channels must be diversified, and whose messages must be rehumanized. Come, brothers, we have far too much work to do for us to play the game of rear guard. Europe has done what she set out to do, and on the whole, she has done it well. Let us stop blaming her, but let us say to her firmly that she should not make such a song and dance about it. We have no more to fear, so let us stop envying her. The Third World today faces Europe like a colossal mass whose aim should be to try to resolve the problems to which Europe has not been able to find the answers. But let us be clear. What matters is to stop talking about output and intensification and the rhythm of work. No, there is no question of a return to nature. It is simply a very concrete question of not dragging men toward mutilation, of not imposing upon the brain rhythms which very quickly obliterate it and wreck it. The pretext of catching up must not be used to push man around, to tear him away from himself or from his privacy, to break and kill him. No, we do not want to catch up with anyone. What we want to do is to go forward all the time, night and day, in the company of man, in the company of all men. The caravan should not be stretched out, for in that case, each line will hardly see those who precede it, and men who no longer recognize each other meet less and less together, and talk to each other less and less. It is a question of the Third World starting a new history of men, a history which will have regard to the sometimes prodigious thesis which Europe has put forward, but which will also not forget Europe's crimes, of which the most horrible was committed in the heart of man, and consisted of the pathological tearing apart of its functions and the crumbling away of his unity. And in the framework of the collectivity, there were the differentiations, the stratification, and the bloodthirsty tensions fed by classes. And finally, on the immense scale of humanity, there were racial hatreds, slavery, exploitation, and above all, the bloodless genocide which consisted in the setting aside of 15,000 millions of men. So, comrades, let us not pay tribute to Europe by creating states, institutions, and societies which draw their inspiration from her. Humanity is waiting for something from us other than such an imitation, which would be almost an obscene caricature. If we want to turn Africa into a new Europe and America into a new Europe, then let us leave the destiny of our countries to Europeans. They will know how to do it better than the most gifted among us. But if we want humanity to advance a step further, if we want to bring it up to a different level than that which Europe has shown it, then we must invent and we must make discoveries. If we wish to live up to our people's expectations, we must seek the response elsewhere than in Europe. Moreover, if we wish to reply to the expectations of the people of Europe, it is no good sending them back a reflection, even an ideal reflection, of their society and their thought, with which from time to time they feel immeasurably sickened. For Europe, for ourselves, and for humanity, comrades, we must turn over a new leaf. We must work out new concepts and try to set afoot a new man. End of Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. Franz Fanon was born in 1925 on the island of Martinique. He studied medicine in France, specializing in psychiatry. When he was 27, he published his first book, Black Skin, White Mask, telling of his observations as a black and psychiatrist in the Antilles. During the French-Algerian War, Fanon was assigned to a hospital in Algeria and soon found out his sympathies to be with the rebels. Out of his experience came two further works, L'Enfant de la Révolution Algérienne, published in English as A Dying Colonialism, and this volume. In 1961, it was discovered that he was suffering from cancer. He was brought to Washington too late for medical care and died there in December at the age of 36.
And that will do it for Franz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy. Anybody have any suspicions about Fanon's death? Cancer, 36, relatively young age. Maybe he could have written more. Any suspicions before we wrap up? A lot of black people died at a very young age around that same period of time. Anywho, if folks have commentary that they would like to share, concluding thoughts, feel free. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I think Mr. Demrefour should be with us. I'll look for other folks as we proceed. Our caller at, let's see, 8726, I think, says Emmy, 8726, you should be with us as well. Were you just listening, or did you have commentary you wanted to share? The caller, 8726.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings. Apologies, wet fingers, and trying to unlock the phone. But I think his last few sentences, maybe last couple paragraphs, I was listening. I wasn't actually following along in the text, but where he's talking about the world after white supremacy, racism, white supremacy. I think that what he's saying is very accurate. I think that there's a lot of truth to it, and I think that it's one of the worries that people have. I forget, it must have been some song or something that I heard earlier today. I wasn't necessarily listening to it, but pretty much saying that if, I think it was actually J. Cole too, that if black people were to become empowered, that we would just do what white people did. I think that perhaps there might be some legitimacy to that, only because we don't necessarily have, like he said, like Fanon mentioned, a model with which to envision, or haven't had in the past, a model with which to create a society or a world that we envision. But I think that Fanon's saying, or calling upon the use of an imagination to create something completely different. And then I know Mr. Fuller has definitely clarified a lot of what that could look like, how we conceptualize justice and the future of the world, as we would put it, or as we could put it, as the world could put it. And I think that that's very true. He said what he said, Mr. Fanon. He did what he did. And I respect that he did what he did and he said what he said. I think going forward, one of the things that as I attempt to counter racism, I will pay extra special attention to word choice and how I phrase things. And if I'm trying to be constructive and helpful, I know that even though there are complex, the system is complex and there are a lot of complexities to things, it's not, sometimes not very easy to explain, but finding the simplest way to do so, I think, is the most constructive way to make sure that we're all on the same page and what is what I'm saying or what's being said is transmitted clearly. I'm kind of feeling that might be why Gus has chosen the next book. I was able to read a couple of pages, and I'm really excited about that. I think that it's a great follow-up to such a verbose text that uses a lot of jargon, that to read something that analyzes the way that we speak. But back to Mr. Fanon's work, I think that's one of the things I'll take away personally. And then also one of the things I think that non-white people get to do, I think that maybe we've been separated from, because I think that we're told that we're really artistic, but that's really just to be entertaining, but it doesn't really call upon the magic of being artistic and creative, and that's imagination, being able to see something that's not there, not necessarily just relive past traumas as a way of like pseudo healing or something like that, but to envision worlds that are not here, a future that's not present. So I really do think that I appreciate Fanon saying that in his work. I think that about his dying so early from cancer, I'm sure that there maybe, you know, some kind of conspiracy to take out a lot of the black thinkers at that time, even like ones, like maybe in a situation like that. Because I know Bob Marley died under similar circumstances and similar conditions, but I'm not the most knowledgeable person about that. But even if it wasn't that, it's still white supremacy in my mind, because that's what he focused on. So I'm sure at that time, that focus, being that confused, all of your energy going that way, feeling all that you felt studying in France, everything definitely could create a disease state in his body to make the cancer bad. And then having lack of adequate doctors who are really invested in finding the real problem with you, or not problem with you, but the problem that you're facing. So to catch cancer early, early detection is very important, because they caught it too late. So either way, it was racism, white supremacy in my mind. But thank you guys for having us read this, or allowing us to read this and do this. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Jimmy Ford, because you've had great commentary, and thank you all for listening.
Indeed. Appreciate that, Emmy. Mr. Demery Four, any other folks, if you have concluding comments on the text, you should go ahead and speak up now. Don't wait till the last minute. Mr. Demery Four, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, I do. Thanks, Emmy. And I'll be brief. I wanted to say that Dr. Carruthers, making that comparison with the normal African is a lobotomized European. This racist attitude was prevalent during that time. Europe and other parts of the globe, and they even went so far as talking about skull size and all of this. But the part where he said, before concluding, it is worth pointing out that Dr. Carruthers defined the Mau Mau revolt as an expression of the unconscious frustration complex whose reoccurrence could be scientifically treated by radical psychological appropriate methods. And I wonder if that included a frontal lobotomy, because this guy was off his rocker. Also, the part where he's saying that about the guy that's working 16-hour days, and he comes home and his child is crying. He goes to the store to beg for a little wheat or a little oil to feed himself and his kid. But he already owes this guy a lot of money. He can't get anything. And then this overwhelming, immense hatred and desire to kill the shopkeeper. That's, you know, I think that's something that we ought to really investigate of our disposition and our minds. Why do we get so essentially angry at another black person? You know, and then he gives the other part of it where when the guy comes, demands taxes, and he's a European administrator, or he is, I guess he's directly, he's Algerian too, but he's representing the European, and he don't have time to really get angry at this guy. It's almost like, well, these white folks are backing him up, so I'm going to give him a break, I guess. And in the context, I wanted to say something about, you know, when a person's belief systems is violated, you have a socialization process, you know, where your mores and beliefs, your core cultures are formulated. And then when someone just takes that and just tears it apart or leads you to believe that there's no difference in right or wrong, there's no starting point, no ending, you know, you're, that's when the, in my belief, is that's when the psychosis develops. And it's said that in context of oppression, like that of Algeria, for the colonialized living does not mean embodying a set of values, does not mean integrating oneself into the coherent, constructive development of a world. To live simple means not to die. To exist means staying alive. Every day grown is a victory. And that about sums it up for non-white black people in America. I was, you know, just thinking, you always say we don't understand exactly what it means to be white. And to be white in this society with the things that they do and the way that they live their life, if that constitutes true living, then we are struggling to survive and we're under stabilized accommodations. I would interject that, you know, we may not, as a collective group of people, may not actually be living, simply existing, and that every day we wake up, we're just glad to be here. And then, this part, comrades, we have nothing else to do but create a third Europe. The West saw itself as a spiritual adventure. It is in the nature of the spirit, meaning the spirit of Europe, that Europe justifies its crime, legitimized the slavery in which it held four-fifths of humanity. And I think he's talking about, when they were coming up with this symbol, we will conquer, talking about the cross. So spirituality, religion assisted them in their crimes against humanity. And then where he says four-fifths of humanity suffered, that would leave one-fifth for the white. And then if Dr. Cress-Welsing identifies them as one-tenth of the population, there still may be hope, because one-fifth would one-fifth as opposed to one-tenth would signify that they are diminishing, and that they may be not replenishing themselves. And the last thing is, the third world must start over a new history of man, which takes account not only the occasional prodigious themes maintained by Europe, but also its crimes, the most hideous of which has been committed at the very heart of man, the pathological dismemberment of his function, the erosion of his unity, and in the context of the community, the fracture, the stratification, and the bloody tensions fed by class, and finally, the immense scale of humanity, the racial hatred, slavery, exploitation, and above all, the bloodless genocide, whereby 1.5 billion men have been written off. And I think that's probably the most condemning thing that he said about white people in this book. But I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus. I was happy to hear that this was the end, and we'll be moving on. Thanks for taking the call.
Indeed. That does happen sometimes when you're reading. Every book that you read, at least in my experience, every book that I've read is not medical apartheid, warmth of other suns. Sometimes you get a book just like you get a film or anything else that, this one was not the best. But you try to learn what you can and keep it moving. And at least with these type of books, great reference point, because I'm sure Fanon will be mentioned by somebody moving forward. So we should all, have a question or at least perk up since we will have participated in this collectively. 5771, caller 5771, if you had commentary, proceed.
All right. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Short, quickly, in regards to the last reading, the Dr. Carruthers, the person he mentioned, I did a Google search on him, and the first thing that came up was medical torture. And apparently, in this medical torture, he was implicated by designating interrogation methods of those Mau Mau prisoners. So apparently he had something to do with, he was directly implicated with torturing the Mau Mau prisoners with his methods and, racist scientific observations about, Africans. So that was pretty interesting. In regards to the book, I guess the last chapter of Colonial War and Mental Disorders is probably the most readable chapter in this book. I felt that we could have probably read that chapter and it would probably been a decent book. I kind of think that the other chapters were a little wordy in regards to that, but as we know, he's a victim of racism as well, and we're all learning, but I think there are bits and pieces that can be plucked out of this book in regards to it. If he would have just, well, the unfortunate thing is he had died before, you know, he finished this book. And I agree, you know, the racist probably had a hand in kind of disorganizing the information in this book. So it could have been a much better read in regards to that. I kind of felt that if he would have finished this book before he died, it probably would have been a little different than it is now. But I still feel that, you know, we can still, you know, pluck some information here or there. You just have to kind of find it in regards to this book. So that, I guess that's all I have for now. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Interesting metaphor, plucking useful bits of info out of the book. I reckon I would say, to inform people, this book, I definitely think that it's significant that he was dying. He died the same year that this book was published in 1961. But at least one of the problems for me with this book, he spends a lot of time criticizing other non-white people, not so much criticizing white people, and even sometimes doesn't even say white people. He'll say colonialism or find other way to get away from indicting directly the people, men and women, like his wife, who practice racism, white supremacy, the individuals classified as white. That tendency to heavily criticize other non-white people, other victims of white supremacy, is also in Black Skin, White Mask, which was published, you know, years before he passed. In fact, it's even heavier in my view in that book, and I have read that book multiple times. Yeah, I don't know. Some of the critiques are consistent in his writing. That's also a book that's widely celebrated, in my opinion. And also just him being married to a white woman. As I read this last portion, I think Mr. Demery Ford reminded us that Fanon is quoted in Marimba Ani's Yorugu. He's quoted, you know, by many folks. But she talks about Dr. Ani, the concept of universalism, and how Black people, as a result of racism, that we talk about our experience as though everyone is included, and or this wanting to seek out and be unified in brotherhood with everybody, including white people often. And I felt a lot of that down the final pages of Wretched of the Earth, and directly, indirectly, even if it's not there, just the fact that he married a white woman. A lot of what, even, you know, when he's talking down the stretch about not emulating what was done in Europe and not, you know, just going out to mimic what they have done and they're the only model, a lot of that, it's difficult for me to hear that from any Black person if they're married to a white person. The same logic that I applied to the film Get Out, and saying that I don't know how this film could be construed as a critique, really, or a serious critique of racism or critique of quote-unquote interracial relationships, since the person who put the project together is married to a white person. That sort of contradiction looms large for me. And it looms large when Black people are being critiqued, because there's a lot of that in this book and a lot of that in Black Skin, White Mask. And in Black Skin, White Mask is even more acute, because he's doing a lot of criticizing other Black people who are in tragic arrangements with white people. So at any rate, it's interesting that, again, I just come back, this book is very, very popular for any reason. There are other psychiatrists who've written books about racism that are not this popular. There are other Black people from the same time period who wrote books about racism that are not this popular, that white people do not, you know, scream from the halls of the academies from this coast, across the pond, Oxford, wherever you happen to be on the globe. You know, you can be rest assured they'll probably have a copy of Frantz Fanon, and he will be widely extolled in their classes. That alone is reason for suspicion. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. Plucking. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. I'll look over the text for any final tidbits I want to get in from the final portion we read. Did we miss anything? Any other thoughts folks wanted to make sure they shared before we move forward? Indeed, indeed. I had the book jacket just so that I can give a quick preview for the book we're starting next week that I am very excited about and looking forward to. This was my selection. We've not read any of Mr. Postman's works before, but he's been referenced. He was referenced on the very first program we came back to the air. The book we're reading, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk and What to Do About It. This is just from the book jacket to give folks an idea of what to expect with the text. He says, or for the book jacket, it reads, human cooperation and understanding come, if they come at all, through talk. But so do conflict, cruelty, and misunderstanding. How can we know where our talk will lead us? How can we avoid talking stupid, or even worse, talking crazy? In this important book, Neil Postman tries to make visible the structure and causes of stupid talk and crazy talk, two of the oldest nemesis of the human race. Quite simply, stupid talk is a language that does not achieve its purpose because of the inappropriateness of its tone or vocabulary or assumptions. It is talk that does not work. Crazy talk is talk that usually does work, but in working promotes purposes that are unreasonable or overwhelmingly trivial or even evil. We are all burdened by such defeating ways of talking at one time or another, says Professor Postman, and by learning to recognize them, we take a first step toward reducing their power over us. We must bear in mind, he insists, that stupidity and craziness are not only forms of talking, they are achievements. We learn how to talk stupid or crazy. We may therefore unlearn how to do it as well. In straightforward language and trying to avoid stupid talk of his own, the author presents a philosophy of everyday language and identifies and explains most of the important varieties of stupid talk and crazy talk. Fanaticism, reification, sloganeering, model muddles, role fixation, Eichmannism, and definition tyranny, to name just a few. In his most provocative book since Teaching as a Subversive Activity, Neil Postman has opened our awareness to a new way of thinking about the way we talk and of talking about the way we think. That is the book jacket for Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, which we will be starting next week. Neil Postman is a suspected racist, and racism does come up in this book explicitly. In fact, we can talk about that next week, but I'm super excited, looking forward to this book, which I did pick. And yes, as Emmy said, great follow-up to Frantz Fanon. Not great writing, regardless of what you think about the concepts or things that you present. It is not writing that is easy to follow, easy to grasp, not presented in a straightforward manner, as we just heard in the jacket. With that, everyone got their final comments in that they needed about Frantz Fanon or book-related matters for the week. Everyone satisfied? Grand. We will be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on a week. The loss. I think it is fascinating. O.J. Simpson was released from prison in Nevada the same day as the Las Vegas shooting. Just happened to be, or did it? Anyway, we'll be here tomorrow. We'll talk about what happened over the past 7 days. If you have counter-racist suggestions and what have you, tune in at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, Saturday evening. With that, thanks for the folks for tuning in, for folks hanging in, for Frantz Fanon. Labored through it. Hopefully, folks, as I said, got something constructive from the material. If nothing else, we can check that off of our list of texts to read. With that, I again suggest sobriety would be best. If you're going out to frolic, it's getting cool, whatever you're going out to do, if you're going out to, I guess, do any of the football games or other outdoor activities while the weather is not too cold yet, sobriety would be best. I do not think things are going to be better if you should stumble upon a white person, badge or no, and have to make some life-saving decisions. I don't think being under the influence will make that situation lean in your favor. Certainly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, driver, or as a passenger, you do not want to be intoxicated. Also, make sure you buckle up. If you have got to consume any intoxicants, make sure you plan that out and have a fail-proof code. That means you will not be in contact with any whites or any disruptive non-white people where things could go, destructive. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.